Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
This is Viv Albertine. It is a super thrill for me to be here with someone I have admired for so many years, and thought I knew what I admired her for until I read her first book, Clothes, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. And I discovered that along with being a tremendously brave person, a fabulous musician, she's a great writer. And this book is many, many things. It's the best book about punk, among others. But it's much more than that. And we're here to talk about that, but also Viv Albertine's new book, To Throw Away Unopened, which is a very, very different kind of book. Viv, you were going to start off with a couple of readings.
Yeah. I thought I'd start off with one. I've made them shorter than they are in the book, but one little chapter from the first book and one chapter from the second book. So the first one is set in 1976 when I'm on the White Riot tour with the Slits supporting the Clash. It's the first time the Slits have ever played live. We've probably only held instruments for a matter of 3 or 4 months. I'm going out with Mick Jones, the Clash's guitarist, who we met at art school. So anyway, there are hundreds of people there, and I count in the first song. 1, 2, 3, 4. And off we go, careening through. Let's do the split, and I'll shit on it as fast as we can play it. Mick Jones explains to me later on the tour that when you shout 1, 2, 3, 4, you're setting the speed of the song. I don't know this. I've copied it off the Ramones LP. And I just think it's a warning to the band that you're starting... that you're starting and it's just to be shouted as fast and loud as possible. We all play the song at different speeds. Ari screams, I thrash at my guitar. Palmolive smashes the drums. The stage is so big and Tessa's so far away I can't even hear what she's doing on bass. There's roaring and squealing and air rushing and heat like we've all been hurled into the mouth of a volcano. We each play the song separately at our own speed. We do know we should play together, but we can't. I hope that if I remember my part and the others remember theirs, that with a bit of luck, we'll all end at the same time. That doesn't happen. Palmolive is the last, still clattering away obliviously at the drums. The rest of us glare at her until she looks up, realises we've all finished, gives the side tom a couple more thumps and stops. 1, 2, 3, 4! On to the next song, Shoplifting. A hail of spit rains down on us throughout the set. Great gobs of phlegm land in my hair, my eyes, and on my guitar neck. My fingers slide around as I try to hold down the chords. I look over at Ari and see spit land in her mouth as she sings. I don't know if she gobs it back out or swallows it. I have to look down quickly at my hands or I'll lose my place. Then a skinhead jumps up and tries to pull Ari off stage. I stop playing, unplug my guitar, and hit him over the head with it. A very heavy lump of wood, a Telecaster. Palmolive punches him, she's a good fighter, and the bouncers haul him off by his collar, blood dripping down his face. Yeah. And I miss those days. Oh dear. Anyway, yeah, it's a good way to get the old anger out those days. But anyway, my next one is from the second book. It's, you know, it's obviously one, you pick a chapter and it doesn't tell you what the whole book's about or even give you a flavour of it, but this is just randomly picked. And it's about hair, my hair, and the way women who have hair on their bodies feel about it. How much I've been sort of obsessed with the hair on my body all my life since, you know, I reached puberty. It was a very difficult piece for me to write this part of the book because I am ashamed of my body hair and I'm ashamed of being ashamed of it actually as well. And this is a quote from Aisha Mirza, a young writer who lives in New York, from her piece on being mad, brown and hairy. And I must say, she got me at the title, but the rest of the article is brilliant as well. she says, "Body hair, for many of us, is a constant microaggression attacking us from within. No matter how many times we rip it out from the root, no matter how much we convince ourselves that it's really not that deep, it exists as a mental burden." So, I use quotes from women as a thread running throughout the book, sort of one of the stratas of the book. Anyway, it takes a concerted effort for me to look acceptable dressed, but that is nothing compared to the amount of work it takes for me to look acceptable undressed. And this is mostly due to the hair. I have lots of hair on my head, and people often comment enviously on it, but what they don't realise is that it's also all over my body. The older I get, the more unmanageable the hair. That should really have reverb on it when I say that. The hair becomes. I've dreamt about my hair most nights for years. I mean, decades, actually. Eyebrow hair, face hair, underarm hair, arse hair, pubic hair. I've dreamt that the hair on my legs is as long, black and shiny as licorice bootlaces, and that the bootlaces trail out of the bottom of my jeans and drag along the ground as I walk down the street. That the strands are so long that people can't help stepping on them and jerking me back as I walk. In another dream, I have just one long, thick, dark brown hair sprouting from under my nose, which reaches down to my boots, and try as I might, I can't pull it out. Or there's one where the hair on the backs of my fingers is so long that I have to plait it, and the plaits swish about as I wave my hands around when I talk. The other night, I dreamt I didn't have time to go home for a hair-removing session before I went out, and by the end of the evening, the hair on my upper lip and chin had grown into a thick tussock of pale brown seagrass, and I had to hack it off with garden shears. As you can tell, I am seriously unhinged about hair. I was even too embarrassed to say my father was from Corsica when I was young, because the name had the sound coarse in it, and I thought it would draw people's attention to the hair on my face, arms and legs. To quote Nora Ephron, always so good on hair, she says, "The amount of maintenance involving hair is genuinely overwhelming. Sometimes I think that not having to worry about your hair anymore is the secret upside of death."
I also like the line from Nora Ephron that you quote in your new book, that after you pass a certain age, the only time you have a good hair day is when you pay for it.
She's so good, yeah.
I have so many things I want to ask you about, and they fly all over the place, but I think I want to start strong, and that is, there's a phrase associated with the slits, anger is an energy. And it's a phrase that Johnny Rotten took to title his second autobiography, a wonderful book. And after reading To Throw Away Unopened, that sounds pretty glib, because this is a book so full of anger, sometimes directed, leaping off the page, sometimes, you know, the story you're telling, driven by anger. And there is a kind of movie running through the second half of the book, with a fight that you were having with your sister over your mother's
deathbed. Yeah.
and it just, you know, it unfolds cinematically, chapter by chapter, with interruption and interruption. We're constantly taking back there. And I just like to hear about what you went through writing that.
No, I think anger is the core of the book. You're right there. I didn't really intend to write a second book, but for one reason or another, none of it glamorous or writerly, I thought, I might as well get on with it and do another one. I'm a bit bored. I've got nothing to do. You know, and I liked the neediness of the book needing me to come and see to it 4 hours a day. So I started to write another one, and I knew what I was going to write. I was going to write part non-fiction and part fiction, and the fiction was going to be this angry middle-aged woman who was so full of resentment and anger that she had murderous thoughts and eventually committed murder. and the non-fiction bit was going to be about the area of East London I lived in and me wandering down the streets having my pleasant thoughts. So as I was about 3 months into this, writing both parts, I thought, Viv, face the fact that you are that angry middle-aged woman. You're writing about yourself. And actually, it's much more interesting if you write the truth and don't fictionalise it. Even though that was embarrassing for me, because being born in the 50s, it's really probably even the last 2 years that anger has even been talked about. It seems so weird in relation to women. And it was sort of implicit always in the culture I was brought up in, just London in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that to be angry was sin of all sins, unfeminine. So to be unfeminine, to not fit into society, to be not pretty or not beautiful in the eyes of society, to be, you know, it was considered ugly. And, well, I think it still is. You know, there's still the whole nasty woman thing and all that kind of thing. But punk for those couple of years was that the only, it was so exciting to me, and I think the other few women who are involved in it, because we could show our anger. We could shout on stage, we could scream, we literally kicked doors down with our boots. We, you know, everything that we felt came out without, you know, within at least a little subgroup of people who didn't judge us for it. It felt normal in that little situation. I mean, it didn't, the minute we hit the streets or the minute we tried, you know, to be part of an industry, then it wasn't acceptable, but within our little bunch it was. So I seemed subconsciously to be drawn to that subject because I wanted to write about this middle-aged woman full of anger and murderous thoughts. And when I faced facts that it was myself and that I was going to ditch the fiction side of things and write about my own anger, then I started to, as you do when you write, go on a little detective hunt. Well, where did this anger come from? How come I'm this age when you're supposed to be mellowing and I'm still absolutely full of rage and anger? And, you know, it took 3 years, I think, to sort of unearth it, but I did unearth it. And, you know, at first I was led to punk times and how come I picked up a guitar at 21 when I couldn't play, couldn't sing, came from a working class background, had no confidence, was very badly educated, never had a music lesson in my life. How come I was one of about five girls in the country who picked up a guitar? And probably the first almost of those five as well. It was an extraordinary thing to do when I looked back at it. And I thought it was this sort of anger and rage that was driving me that gave me the confidence to do that. And then I thought, well, where did it come from after I'd had this, you know, inauspicious sort of start to life? And of course, I started to trace it through to my mother and her anger. And when I looked at her life in depth, because she died the night my first book was launched. Whilst I was at the book launch, I got the phone call that she had 2 hours. No, was it 2 hours or 40 minutes? 40 minutes left to live, yeah. After she died, I found her diaries of a certain period of time during the last 2 years of her marriage with my father. And so that started to paint a big picture of her anger and why she was so angry and these things that had happened to her, partly of her own doing, but she only did them because of the environment she was born into. And then I traced why those things happened back through to my grandmother. And it was just so interesting how through generations of any sort of oppression that carries on through generations, it does get passed down to, you know, grandchild, great-grandchild, you know, and it lands. It goes through generation and generation till hopefully, if it works creatively, at some point there's a child who is at a stage and an environment and in a culture who can kick against what has been happening through the generations. You know, maybe they've happened to get a decent education, or maybe they've been politicized in some way, or maybe their intelligence is, you know, they've got a good, suddenly the genes have come together. That didn't happen to me, but but I did have the good, you know, I did have the time. I did have the environment right, and I had a couple of generations of anger building up in me, which it just burst forth at that time. I was ready. I was ripe. I was actually groomed as well by my mother to be an angry rebel. We had nothing else, really. I mean, there was no way I was going to break out of what was really like a 1940s culture, Britain in the 70s. You know, we look back at the 70s now and we see sort of orange plastic and brown curvy patterns and, you know, all this sort of funky furniture. We think of it as a style, but actually living in Britain in the 70s was like living in the 40s. It was almost pre-war, because after the war, women did have to go back. Actually, I would quite like to read something quickly here, which sort of says it better than me waffling on, which might explain. It's not very jolly or anything, but it might just explain what, you know, where it came from a bit. The title of the chapter is "We Are the Granddaughters of the Witches That You Could Not Burn," and it's named after a Garda Amer art piece. She's an artist, and I found that piece, and I just loved that title, because that sort of said what I needed to say about how it goes through generations, anger of, you know, of some sort of repressed energy and equality. One of the reasons feminism took such a strong hold in my mind and in the minds of many girls of my generation is that we were brought up by repressed and dissatisfied women who had grown into adulthood during the Second World War. These women had learned new skills, tasted independence, and then had to dissolve back into the shadows of their dark brown Victorian homes and watch from behind their ironing boards as the swinging 60s unfolded. In the words of the academic Jacqueline Rose, we were brought up by women who were part of a generation whose identity was above all to become mothers, and who found themselves, after a devastating war, under the harshest obligation to be happy and fulfilled in that role. To compensate for the freedom and the opportunities she missed out on, my mother did her best, with very little means, to make sure that my sister and I didn't suffer the same fate of domestic drudgery and dependence on a man that befell her. She was highly attuned to the subjugation of women and pointed it out to me at every opportunity, on TV, in the streets, in shops, politics and education. She recounted to me all the injustices she'd suffered, and they lodged firmly in my brain, adding to my own grievances and making me doubly angry with the world. I burned with both her anger and my anger. Perhaps that's how it is for every woman. The repressions of your female ancestors accumulate over the generations, resentment building in great-granddaughter, granddaughter and daughter, like hair clogging a washing machine filter, until at last they build a girl who is so pumped up, full of fury, that she kicks all obstructions out of the way. I just jump to the end of that and say, some women can block this out, patriarchy, misogyny, and get on with life the same way our brains filter out most visual input to the eyes, because if we could see every molecule that's out there, we'd go insane. Well, I can't block patriarchy out. I was trained by my mother to notice it, to seek it out, and to fight it. I mean, she absolutely every day... Oh, thanks. And it wasn't, you know, it doesn't sound so extreme nowadays, maybe, but to a young girl in the 60s, to have a working class mother who was day after day, minute after minute, hour after hour, filling my mind with never rely on a man, you know, never talk to family or love or children as being a good thing. I never heard that my whole life with her. And it never occurred to me that anything was missing in this indoctrination. You know, you go out there, you make a life for yourself. And, you know, as I did crazy things like hitchhike to Amsterdam when I didn't know what country it was in when I was 16, or, you know, or sort of think, I'm going to be in a band, you know, when no girls were in bands, never seen a girl with an electric guitar before. No matter what crazy thing I thought up, which was way out of her knowledge and her comfort zone, she never once said, are you sure? Or, you might fail, or shouldn't you be getting a proper job? Or don't you think... And this went on until I was 50. Actually, it probably went on until she died. But, I was constantly having to go home because everything had collapsed, even in my 50s, and stay in the box room, you know. But, you know, if you are always challenging your life and yourself, you will end up in the box room often. And in fact, you know, I think it was about a week before she died. She could hardly speak anymore from her hospital bed. My mother said to me, Vivi, you're going to have to fight right up till the day you die. And I said, oh, Mom, no, really? And she went, yes. No, she didn't quite, but she almost was the last thing she said. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm exhausted. And she's right, you know, you have to somehow find that energy to make sure you keep yourself on track, keep yourself living the life, you know, you should be leading, and a good life. Anyway, yeah, over to you now. That's...
you talk about doing detective work on your own life, and you had two major clues, and that is when your parents were separating, when they were heading toward divorce, each of their solicitors told them to keep a diary that would make them look good and the other one look bad when it came time for if there were custody issues, if there was property issues, to have something to stand on. And so both your father and your mother did this over a similar period of time. And you found your father's diary, and that comes up early in the book, and it's very difficult and shocking for you to try and reconcile his self-possession and his eliding much of the truth. And then after your mother dies, you find the package, or rather the bag, an old airline bag, that gives the book its title, and you find it up, I think, behind the refrigerator when you're cleaning out the kitchen, standing on a stool, and there's a bag that says to throw away unopened, which of course...
I feel you're slightly giving things away a bit here.
Excuse me?
I feel you're slightly giving away quite important moments in the book here.
Well,
that's for something, it's almost like if it was a detective story, those moments are for people to discover, sort of... I won't
totally say who done it, but that's a harrowing diary, your mother's.
Yeah.
And you communicate with tremendous power the difficulty of reading it, but the difficulty of putting it in the book, in public, it just was scary to me to read, and I think it's one of the most powerful parts of the book, and it will have a powerful effect on anyone who does read it. And I thought, I wish my parents had left something like that. On the other hand, I would be absolutely terrified to read it.
If they wrote on it, "Greal, whatever you do, don't open this." You know, what sort of a challenge is that to a child?
Even a very old child.
Yeah.
The first thing you do is you sort of move it around with your hands for a few minutes, and then you open it.
Absolutely. As well she knew. She knew what kind of a daughter I am very well, and to write on a bag to throw away unopened, was obviously not meant and a challenge, and, she wanted me to find out, it's your own fault, I told you not to open it. What was in there. But what it was interesting, because in the 60s you couldn't get a divorce without proving, sort of bad behavior, affairs,
cruelty and abuse.
Exactly. And even then you had to wait 3 years and prove it in court. So a lot of people probably kept those diaries. And it was so interesting to have, there's me always delving for the truth. And here I had 2 years, exactly the same 2 years, written day by day by my mother and day by day by my father, 1965 to 67, both thinking, bar a few little sort of twirls here and there about how they were the good one, both thinking they'd written the truth. And there's me in between, third person, thinking my truth is the truth. And, and I just realized at the end of the book, I'll never get near the truth. There is no such thing as an absolute truth. And it was sort of quite crushing in a way to think I'm going to have to accept the open-endedness of this. But, first I read my father's diary and I was, thought it was very poignant and sad. And then I read my mother's diary and it made sense of all my father's, sort of poignancy and sadness. And events in both the diaries were, I remembered them all. It's not like they wrote lies. I remembered every event that was spoken about. But I mean, one thing that was quite interesting to show the three different points of view was that before they separated, my mother and father one night decided they were going to sleep in separate bedrooms. And that night, my father said to me, Vivi, will you sleep with me? It's all lonely in my bed on my own. I was 11. And I was a very a child to please, you know, who would please, and said yes, and, you know, of course, and that went on for 3 nights. And at some point, my mother said to me, you know what, I'm going to sleep in your room because, you know, I haven't really got a proper bedroom to sleep in, so I'm going to put my bed in the corner of your room. And I thought, oh, no, I've got my posters on the wall. I don't want my mum in the room, and it's embarrassing. And she said, oh, I'll just creep in and change at night. And you went, no, I'm there. And I thought, oh, God, she's such a loser kind of thing. But didn't think that word in those days, but it's the same. Only to realise, of course, when I read her diaries and put two and two together, that my father was on the verge of abusing me, that she slept in my room every night so there would be no creeping about. And, you know, and there was me thinking she was a loser until I read that diary and absolutely placed all the events together and what was happening. And so that's, to me, you know, the ultimate illustration of trying to find the truth. You know, his would be, oh, I was only being friendly, I was lonely. She would be, I wasn't going in your bedroom for that reason. And mine was, oh, my mum was a loser. And, yeah, and I think also illustrates how much mothers do keep quiet from children and sort of protect them from things that they don't know are going on one way or another, yeah.
One strain that runs through both of your books, you know, some people could call it anger, but you could also think of it as different forms of free speech and a person discovering her voice and how to use it and refusing to give it up. Over the weekend, I was at a conference in Seattle and I met Palmolive, who says hello. And one of the things she said about the slits when at a panel about the Ronettes and the Shangri-Las, and somebody asked her, what was the slits about for you? And she said, we wanted to hear each other. Not just because, you know, the amplifiers are messed up and I can't hear you, but we were interested in what each of us had to say. We wanted to hear each other. And there are incidents in both your books that somebody could take as anger. There's one that is just remarkable. This is your characterizing the slits in your first book. We hate double standards and false people, and all of us are very vocal in our damnation of any hapless person who crosses our path who hasn't thought rigorously about life. And that word rigorously is one you come back to again and again to characterize what punk was about for you. And you're in a TV studio with a singer going on, in your words, in a peasant gypsy-type dress and warbling away in a breathy little girl voice. And we went up to her afterwards and told her she was shit, that she was compounding stereotypes and doing a disservice to girls, that she should take a good look at what she was doing and how she was projecting herself and be honest about who she was, and she burst into tears. We do that sort of thing all the time. And in your new book, early on, you're in your 50s, maybe your mid or late 50s. You're playing in a pub, playing your guitar, singing, trying to get your songs across. And there's a table of loudmouth drunks right up front, and they're drowning you out, and they're making it impossible for anybody to follow anything you might be saying or might be singing or might be playing. And you ask them if they would be quiet, if maybe they could move to the back, go to the bar. Maybe you could describe what happens next.
Yeah, and I wasn't proud of this. Because, you know, obviously physical violence is not something that one should resort to. But So I was standing on stage, I was in my mid-50s, you know, middle-aged woman, electric guitar in little old-fashioned town of York, cobbled streets and all that, in some bar, and travelled a long way to get there. And, yeah, these bunch of four blokes were out on a sort of what we call a jolly, which is like, you know, the boss had paid for the four of them to have a table in a club one night, and they all get drunk and everything, and everyone else had paid, you know, to see Viv Albertine of the Slits after 20 years. And I only had me and the guitar, so it wasn't making, you know, it wasn't like a band, you can drown out, those sort of things. So I played a couple of songs, and I said to them, you know, do you think you might be quiet or go to the bar or the back? If, you know, fine if you're not interested. and I carried on playing, and they carried on shouting and talking, laughing, taking absolutely notice and no notice. And I felt like, you know, I think I say in the book, it's like when, you know, you sort of asked a bunch of your sons to be quiet, and they're like, oh, shut up, Ma, you know, just bring us more peanuts kind of response. I felt utterly sort of belittled and not taken any notice of. And I knew, you know, most of the audience were people who respected the slits and everything. And I thought, I can either just battle on through this to the end, or I can challenge it. And I thought, fuck it, come on. And you know, there's something very radical about a middle-aged woman even being on stage with a guitar. But when she puts it down, I walked over to the table and I said, do you know how your behaving makes me feel? Because I have done a bit of, you know, work on myself, and I know how you're supposed to do your mirroring and your, that. So they foolishly went, no. And I thought, fools. And so I picked up the first big pint of beer and said, like this. Got every one of them in the face in a lovely amber arc. And it felt so good. But I picked up the next one, Guinness this time, lovely dark beer, and then I sort of, without saying anything, did the next lot as well. So they're all sitting there dripping, but one of them was a very, very aggressive young man. He had a sort of wildness in his eyes, and he stood up to attack me, and I thought, I better get in there first for this one. And I said, you want to fight? You want to fight? Okay, then. I picked up a bottle. And I said, let's take it outside then. I said it so much more horribly than this, with loads of swear words and my eyes as cold and hard, because the thing is, I'd fought nearly every day of my life in the 70s. You know, I had took my life in my hands all the time. Bottles were thrown at me. Our singer was stabbed twice in the street in front of me, just for being what we were. I mean, we were spat at constantly. I mean, we were abused. It wasn't unusual to me, but I think it was unusual in their eyes, in a middle-aged woman. So anyway, when I did that, he sat back down, and I saw the sort of people step back into the shadows, or the audience, and then the DJ put a jolly record on, and I said, no, I haven't finished yet, I'm going to finish my set, and I got back up and finished the set, and actually, it went round Twitter and everything that, you know, Viv Albertine bottled some guys in York, you know, it all got blown out of proportion, but I just kept quiet about it from then on. And you know, I'm not proud of it, but there is a quote, and it's in my book, that there are times in your life when you have to use violence to come to your own defence, and let's hope it's rare when that happens. And I also said in the book that some people might think that was not a necessary time, but to me it was necessary. It was something new I was doing, something I was doing in my 50s. I was coming back with expectations from other people, and I was damned if I was going to let what I had built up over those years slip away that night. So, yeah, it was. I'm not sure that should be clapped, but yeah.
Well, that story, in the middle of it, you say your old punk attitude comes back to you when you need it.
It does.
Which is a tremendously moving thing.
Yeah.
There's a moment in To Throw Away Unopened. Give me a second.
It's not Mrs. Fuck Bollock, is it? Mrs. Bollock's thing.
No. You're talking about leaving your mother. When I reached the front gate, I looked up at Mum's third story window to see if she was waving goodbye. And I felt giddy like a true rebel, much more rebellious. Oh, but there was no twitch of the yellow satin curtains this time. This is after an argument. And I felt giddy like a true rebel, much more rebellious than when I was in the slits, to revolt against a lifetime of habit and family expectations was much harder to do, and possibly mean and foolish when your mother is dying and you're supposed to be good and kind. Much harder to do than rebelling against society. I jumped into my car and pushed the key. That maybe is the struggle that your mother was telling you would have to fight till you die. not just against society, which is always there, but at what Alexander Trokey once said, we must meet the enemy where he lives inside of us.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways the enemy is inside of us. There's another quote, which I can't remember, it's from a feminist, it's very hard to fight the enemy when it's inside your head. You know, after years of indoctrination by society and grooming and, you know, capitalism and consumerism dangled in front of you, of course, there's all that, you know, and sort of conforming to stereotypes, etc., etc. That's all in your head. But this part there was about how the family, how hard it is to shake family expectations, you know, where you are in the family, how you've behaved when you were young. I think very much often parents sort of set children against each other or start to try and define them, or you're the clever one, you're the funny one, you're the, you know, and it's hard to fight that as well, which is also in your head. And I think that's the hardest thing almost to fight is how your family places you if you haven't had a very constructive family background. And to dare to say, I am not going to fulfill this role in the family anymore. Because if, as I say in the book, if someone in the family says, I'm not going to play this role anymore that has been made for me over the years since I was a baby, by my siblings, by you, by whatever, the wider family. And I think we all do get given a slight role within a family. If anyone dares to say and demonstrate they're not going to play that role anymore, it means everyone in the family has to change. And, you know, everyone finds change hard. Families don't like change very much. And, you know, you're going against all of that. And there will be a lot of resistance, mental and resistance to, I think, anyone daring to change. You know, you'll be ridiculed, but you'll be laughed at if you try and do something different. You'll be different from the role prescribed. You'll be belittled. You know, it's all different ways. You know, you'll be maybe left out of things or talked about behind your back. And I knew I was taking all that on, and it was only a matter of months before my mother died that I started to see what role I'd been placed in within the family for 50-odd years. Yeah, and I knew it was a bit of a stupid time. But in a way, to challenge that, but in a way, you become so clear, I think, when death is so near like that. When death of a parent especially can really clarify your mind. And that's why I think I saw it then as well. So even though it was a kind of insensitive time to start saying, I'm not playing this role anymore, even though I didn't say it out loud, I changed my behaviour. It was due to the time that I saw it. So, yeah, it's a very subtle thing, and it's very hard to see from within a situation. You know, I say in the book, it's a very hard puzzle to solve, because when you are one of the pieces, you can't see it objectively. So it took something like my mother's impending death to give me the clarity. You know, and I think there are certain sort of traumatic situations in life that can bring the gift of clarity with them as well.
I remember seeing you perform at the Kitchen in Brooklyn in 2009. You were on the same bill with the Raincoats. And you talked about, to go back to this word that I think for you so characterizes punk, you talked about what destroyed the punk scene, which was heroin coming in, brought by Johnny Thunders. And I remember you saying it, the words are just sort of etched in my brain. There were all these rigorous people questioning everything. And within 2 weeks, all they cared about was where they could get their next fix. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy written out in one sentence. You said something else that night when you made some reference to not looking your age, which is something of an understatement, and you called it the curse of the slits. What did you mean by that?
We all look young for our age. So I sort of half joking, you know, that it's a curse, but we all look young. And you know, I'm often asked, you know, I'm 63, how I look like this, haven't had surgery or anything. I don't think I look that great, obviously, and also, except when I'm not got my glasses on, I look pretty good because I can barely see. And everything's very soft, and I can see why nature's done that to us old people, because it does make everything look kind of rosy. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting. A couple of things I stumbled over about the slits. You know, one was, oh, that's interesting. We all look young for our age. I mean, like, at least 10 years younger. And I wonder if that's due to the fact that we did really get out a lot of that anger, whereas it, you know, a lot of young women of our age, of our times, would have kept that anger in. And, you know, there is something to be said for release. But also, another thing I stumbled on about the slits as I wrote, because you do discover things, as you write, it's so interesting, that was that none of us had a father. None of us had a father present in our lives and when we made the band. And I say in the book that I don't think any of us could have possibly lived the wild, unfettered, beyond and outside expectations lives we led, let alone be in a band and dress the way we dressed and been the noisy, angry girls we were in that time if we'd had a father at home. And that is a father we loved just as much as a father who was authoritarian, because in those days, which I say is, was like the 40s, you know, the father came home, you're not allowed to speak to him till he's rested. He got the best chair, absolute peace and quiet. And this is in working class homes, every sort of home. He got the biggest piece of meat, or the only piece of meat often. You know, in our house, it was the only piece of meat. You know, they were treated like sort of kings of their little kingdom. And even if I didn't have a father that I was close to, or that was, you know, an affectionate relationship, but even if I had have had, I would have sort of wanted to please him. I wouldn't want, you know, I know women who are very close to their fathers, and they do have this feeling of wanting to please daddy a bit, you know, or you know, wanting to make daddy proud or whatever. And even though that was a loss for all of us, the four of us, that we didn't have that, it did give us this. I mean, when you think of fairy tales, every fairy tale starts with the parents dying, you know. And you're on your own, you've got to make your way in the world, through the forest, you know, under the bridge with the troll and this, that and the other. But the first thing they do is usually kill off the mother. And because, you know, if you've got a mother alive, generally speaking, you have a little barrier between you and the world. So, yeah, we all had mothers. Two of us, me and Ari, had incredibly open-minded, sort of what might be called at the time lax mothers, which gave us way too much freedom, but of course, again, couldn't have done what we'd done. But it's just so interesting to stumble across the fact that none of us had fathers. And then I thought about the whole punk movement, and I think more or less everyone in, you know, those few years who started it didn't have a father. That were the boys as well, didn't have a father. The only one I can think of was John Lydon. He had a dad, but yeah, the rest of us. No, boy or girl, we didn't have dads.
Well, speaking of punk, I want to ask you a literary question. And that is, in your first book, Close, 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 I can never remember the order.
Don't worry.
Music, 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 boys, boys, boys. The word punk almost always, maybe always, appears in quotation marks, as if to say, did this really happen? Was this a kind of illusion? Is this a dubious concept? But in your new book, there are no quotation marks around the word.
Yeah, it's interesting. The main reason it's in quotation marks is because we were all very disparate, very different people making very different music and often with quite different views. And we were so against labels that we all fought being, you know, homogenized into one lump. And also, the minute the press or anyone could call us a name, punk, for instance, that they can start to dismiss you. They put you in a box and say, oh, he's just a punk, or, you know, punk's had it, or whatever. So we fought labels. That was part of our ethos at the time. And the word punk was cooked up about 18 months into the sort of general happenings of what we were doing. And by that time, I almost think by the time the word came from some straight journalist, that it was dead. It was over by then. Once it was named, you know, then they could start selling T-shirts or putting it down or talking about it. They actually did talk about it in the government, how it was ruining society, punk. But so we were anti-labels. So I put punk in inverted commas because it wasn't our word, and we didn't call ourselves punks, and we didn't invent the word or describe it to ourselves, and we're against labels. So I sort of feel like I'm putting it in, it's lazy of me to use the word even. I mean, I feel lazy using it, but it's shorthand for all those people who did that thing that we did for those 18 months, 2 years, but it's not a term I approve of or condone in any way. But the fact that it's not in, I think by the second book, I definitely would have thought about it, but it was about a year ago I handed the book in, so I'm a bit hazy because I'm very precise about those things, but I think I didn't put it in inverted commas in the second book because I thought it was sounding a bit precious to keep, you know, saying punk, punk, every time I mention it, and I don't think I mention it very often anyway, but yeah, so it was just that, you know, why use a label that someone you don't even agree with, who was that out to put you down, calls you?
Well, we have time for a lot of questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I think you would like that. I know Viv would. So I have to ask you to hold your questions until someone can give you a microphone, since this is all being recorded. So who would like to start, please? Right. Can you give them the mic?
Hi. Your contemporaries, bands around Clash and so forth, adverts, were any of them, did any of them treat you, the Slits, and other women, Susie, as equals, gender-wise, or anything close to that? Who would you think of when I ask that question?
You know, it was extraordinary, but they did. You know, it's extraordinary because of the times and because they were so much less open than now and things like that weren't discussed. But within that bunch, you know, the adverts, the Clash, the Pistols, they treated the other women in bands, the adverts, us, Raincoats, with absolute equality and support. I mean, you know, got to give them that. They didn't mean they didn't go around shagging a load of girls and choose, you know, girls who maybe didn't have the same ethos as us who were doing it. But absolutely within that little scene, there was an equality. There was no talking down. There was no leaving out. There was no putting down. You know, we got that from the journalists. We got that from DJs. We got that from record companies. But really is quite strange that it didn't happen within those bands. I mean, I often think it's because Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood, who ran the shop Sex and, you know, did all the clothes and set up the Sex Pistols, they were so intelligent and enlightened, and Vivian Westwood especially was such a strong woman, that actually their point of view sort of filtered down to anyone who was anything, and there was only such a small scene, but anyone who was anything to do with it. And it, you know, it was maybe, I'm not saying that, no, I was tempted to say a bit like a president, but, you know, they set the tone. They set the tone. They were well-educated. They were radical. They were thinkers. And Vivian Westwood, you know, who's now a famous fashion designer, would not have accepted anything like that from anyone. She was terrifying. And you had to be a terrifying woman in those days to break through patriarchy, you know, and think way outside the box to you know, to have broken through and find a path that wasn't prescribed. So, yeah, so I often think it was down to their sensibilities filtering. I mean, because we all used to meet most nights and sit around a table in a pub or somewhere and talk, and mainly they would talk, and, you know, they were well-read, and they would sort of pass all this stuff on to us. So I can't think how else it possibly was that all these young lads out of this 1940s-style Britain were so supportive and open and yeah, just normal. We were normal with them and they were normal with us, kind of thing. It was a good couple of years.
Eva, right there.
One of the things that you didn't talk about is that you've had a long career as a visual artist and as a film director as well. And that's also a very male-dominated industry. How did your experience in the Slits and what you've done carry over to that part of your career?
Yeah, I didn't realize till I wrote my first book how the way I've dabbled in this, that, and the other in life and always made me feel like, you know, there's that phrase, jack of all trades, master of none. I always felt I'm a flake. I've done a bit of this, bit of that. I'm always retraining, changing tack. But it wasn't until I put it all into a book and slammed it between two cardboard covers that it became a shape of a life. And I realized, it doesn't matter how you live your life, what weird path you take, how many times you change it, change your mind, go back on yourself or whatever. I realized when I wrote that book, it is an utterly valid life. Because there are so many expectations that you'll go to school, go to college, you'll follow a route, you'll family, there's this massive sort of, hangs over us all. So that little bit wasn't a little bit, it was about 20 years in the middle where I went to film school, I did a degree in filmmaking, I came out and for about 15 years was directing. It wasn't the most exciting of times because filmmaking is so collaborative and I was often employed and I had to sort of, I was beholden to producers and editors and time slots and not enough money to actually get the right costume or the right location, whatever. It was so frustrating that I really see it as work that time rather than creativity. But what it did teach me was how to run a team, how to be disciplined, how to be sort of confident in how I spoke. I mean, before then, I was just a working class girl. I mean, I know I shouted my way through the 70s, but it's very different to sort of, doing something where you have to turn up every morning, you have to run a team, you have to sort of turn something in. I've been properly paid. I mean, first time I'd had a proper job in my life. And that's what that taught me, so strangely. And actually, now I'm coming to write. I see very visually because of my film school training. And I wrote quite a few scripts back then as well. And so I sort of, and read a lot of scripts. So that all informs, everything you do in life, whether it is go to college and do something you end up not doing, or whether it is a relationship that went wrong or a huge mistake you made about a job and got fired or whatever, it does keep on piling up in your bank and informing, and I think it's probably not until you get to about 40 odd that it starts to all kind of channel and start informing who you are and, what you're sort of looking forward to in terms of family or life experience or work or whatever. So that was a very sort of disciplined, hardworking, got paid, saved up enough to start to put a deposit down on a little apartment. It was kind of like a bit of belt and braces time, but it's come back to really, really help me. Just as much as my punk days have come back to help me and my days when I taught aerobics have come to help me, my time as a mother where I didn't work for 10 years, that it all informs. But that didn't inform me so much creatively, except for I did get a very good visual sense from it and very, learned a bit of discipline, which I had not had at all until then.
Hi. It seems like you've done so many different things in your life, and I'm curious if it feels more like a natural progression from one to the next, or if it feels like a big reinvention every time.
Yeah, because of course it's all, I chat away here for half an hour, you read a book, and it does seem so seamless. But changing from after the end of the slits, I was absolutely in a wasteland. I mean, I was unemployable. I'd never had a job in my life. I'd been going around with a black eye makeup and spitting and hair, never washed. And I had no sense of discipline, any of that. And I'd just been this sort of rebel running around the streets. And then the slits ended. And this is when our Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher got in. And Britain suddenly became, for the first time, really capitalist. It was the first time Britain has ever sort of it did that shift in the 80s. And there was no room for punk or punk sensibilities. Very small island. So it's not like America can absorb, I think, different bands. There's more loyalty to bands. It's a big country. You can let different things run at the same time. But, in Britain in those days, in the late 70s, there was, the capital city, two radio stations, two music papers, and there was... I was suddenly completely redundant, basically. And I just sort of sat in my mother's box room, back there again. And I think I probably sat for a good year thinking, what the hell can I do? And it took a long time to think, I'm going to have to get educated, so I can go out there and stop living in my mother's box room, or I was living in squats on a mattress found in the street, you know, and I got to about 30 and, you know, it was beginning to wear a bit thin, to be honest. The cold, the hunger, I mean, you know, I'd walk past restaurants and almost, oh, I'd want to mug them. I'd want to go in there and just grab the food. You know, I was so hungry. And, you know, at 30, that does get hard work. So, yeah, I thought I'm going to have to get educated. I'm going to have to make a portfolio and get into college. I chose film. I thought it was the most interesting thing at the time. So I had to make a portfolio, go to evening classes. You know, it's a long slog. And then try and get in, go to the interviews, wonder if I, you know, I couldn't even speak. I couldn't really speak. I'd, you know, most of the girls in the band were from, you know, one was from Spain, one's from Germany. It's not like I used long words in the band. You know, I'd stopped using my mind, really. So I had to learn all that again. It took about 3 years, and I change a lot, and I reckon it normally takes a good 3 to 4 years. And I say in the book, it's a bit like turning a tanker around in the sea. You know, you can't think when you come to a point in life where you realise I'm going down the wrong road, I'm going to have to go back and then go down a different road. It's daunting. I mean, it's a slow process, undoing stuff, you know, building again. But there is time. Time is quite elastic, I realise. I didn't do anything for 20 years, but when I came back, it was like that 20 years. You know, you can not exactly waste 20 years. I better not say that, but, you know, I think it puts a lot of people off. You know, I got told often, oh, you're too old to go back to film, to school, or you're too old to pick up a guitar. I got told that both times. One time I was 29, the second time I was 55. I was both times told I was too old. Yeah, so no, to answer your question, it's a slog, it's daunting, but it can be done, and it's so rewarding when it is done, and time stretches for you, actually. There's some weird magical thing that happens with time when you want to change course.
I feel like I have so much to say, so I'm going to try and be really concise, but this is Nikki, and she and I have been in bands together since high school, punk bands, growing up in a punk scene, and have been struggling with aging in the music scene and what to do with yourself after you stop playing music. And we keep every day, we're like, we need to play, we need to play, we need to go play. And my question is mostly about how do you forge your path? Like, for us, we look to people like you. Well, what did Viv Albertine do? You know, she can do that, we can do that. I went to film school, I'm a designer. Yeah. And so when we see people like you putting out books and living your life, it means something, it means a lot. And so my question is, what do you see your future being? Not just like talking about what you've been, but who you are now and who you're going to be.
I mean, one thing is I don't see the future. And I think that's quite helpful to not have too rigid a vision of where you're going. Keep it loose. And for instance, when I picked up the guitar again in my 50s, my vision went as far as I'd like to be able to play 2 songs in public, sing vaguely in tune, and keep the rhythm kind of steady. I mean, that was literally my goal. As I edged towards that goal, my goal stretched a bit to, if I can draw 50 people to see me, that would be great. You know, then if I can do that, I won't stop. And then when I got to there, you know, then by the time I was there, people started saying, do you want to play here? Do you want to play there? And then it starts to get its own momentum. So I think one thing is, I definitely haven't ever kept a rigid goal. It's, I've had a slight feeling of where I'd like to go. Because I think if you keep it too rigid, you kill it, and it's terrifying. You know, if I think I'd like to play one day in front of 500 people at the City Hall, I mean, you're never going to start, and you can't play a guitar. So, yeah, I think you keep your goals doable and kind of hazy. Meanwhile, whilst I do that, I have some other thing going in my life, which I'm totally freaked out about and worried, and I pour all my angst into that. So it could be like my marriage going down the pan, or I've fallen in love and it's all going wrong. And that seems to be another outlet, which is not something I recommend whatsoever. But it distracts me from the very important thing I want to do. And getting, because if you get too hung up on the thing you really, really want to do, you will fuck it up and be terrified. And, you know, that's even if it's someone you like and you'd like to be with. You know, if you obsessed about them and kept, you know, calling them and texting or whatever, you'd fuck it up. So you've got to think of your work like that person that you fancy. And, yeah, but, I mean, if you're kind of well-balanced, you won't need to have the other thing that I need. So at the moment I've set up moving home and it's all gone wrong, there's a structural problem, and that's keeping my worry gene going. And meanwhile I can enjoy my work, because work's very, very precious to me, and I realise that's what I do. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, when I wrote the first book, I realised that you can take that attitude, the punk musician or whatever, and whether it's through playing music or writing a book or just everyday living life, you can still take that punk attitude with you until the day you die. It can inform whatever you do. For me, it was like how long the sentences were, the fact that, the songs we played in punk days, where we would always have short, sharp ending and not let them waffle on and have guitar solos, and all that informed my writing. So everything you've learned up to this point and through playing, being in a band, and, you know, your friends, and you're still friends after all these years, and all that is your attitude, which will inform everything else you do. And I think there's a time in the middle of your life when you think what you did when you were young, oh, fuck, leave that behind now, it's stupid or whatever. But I found that who you were when you were young and, you know, things you loved come back to you later, and actually you realise, actually, I was quite a pure... There's something pure about what you choose to do when you're young, say 15 onwards. And it wasn't stupid. You were actually nearer to who you were then. And I think you have to find that again in midlife, actually. And you're usually, if you look back at who you were when you were young, insecure, yeah, you know, doing things wrong all the time. But the sort of things that attracted you then is probably nearer to who you were than the stuff in the middle where you're trying to get home and trying to be part of a society and all that kind of thing. You know, I just found that's when I wasted my time in the middle of my life trying to fit in. Yeah. Old.
I just want to go back to the anger that you talked about, the anger of your mother and her generation, how it was passed to you, and how you see that in your own daughter, and whether you see it has changed, whether it's been passed down yet again, or how it's morphed or converted itself.
Yeah, that's interesting, because my daughter, when I'm up on stage and I'm saying, shut up, you know, if you to those guys or whatever, she says, oh, Mom, anger's so old-fashioned. And she thinks all my angst is old-fashioned. Mind you, that's before the last 5 years really kicked off. So I think she might be getting a bit angry now. She's very chilled. It hasn't gone on to her. And I think that's possibly because society has changed a certain amount for girls. She has so many more options than I ever had. Slightly more confidence. I still think young women lack confidence. But, yeah, it has moved on for her. She doesn't need that sort of anger yet, although the world has changed in the last 5 to 8 years enough to be bringing that back. So, when she up till about the age of 15, she's 19 now, I was beginning to think, ooh, what boring old life you're going to live. I was thinking, I won't tell her, but God, it's dull. Poor thing. You know, and being able to get clothes so easily in shops, and they were so cheap, and, you know, there's no going to, oh, you know, I don't know what you call them here, but we call them jumble sales, buying old things, or even we have put, you know, black plastic rubbish bags and made them into dresses. There was none of that for her. I thought, what a dull, flat line of a life. And, you know, music, of course, we all know how we feel about music. And but then the world did start to shift, actually. And also with the internet, she, as all young people, have become very aware, much more than we were when we were young, globally, of what's going on. And, I think she's got a very interesting life ahead of her now. But the anger so far... And I wonder if young people need that kind of anger. You know, we were in such a stupid, sort of frustrated, narrow-minded society back then. I know it's going on now, but at least there are ways everyone can communicate with each other. That I literally kicked down doors. I mean, we literally, the Slits, pulled boys off stage and unplugged their guitars and got on ourselves. I mean, I don't know if certain, you know, certainly sort of white girls, privileged girls, don't have to do that to be heard. There are other parts of society that do have to do that to be heard. But I'm not sure, you know, when she said anger is so old-fashioned, I wonder if she kind of had a point in a way that maybe people who are in privileged situations should be more about enabling than making themselves heard, kind of thing. I'm sort of treading a bit carefully because I don't want to put down young people, but I do think there's room for them to, certain privileged young people to, and I think they realise it, to actually, rather than, you know, if I was a young woman now, I would not be getting up on stage, playing 3-minute songs, you know, having people clap after every 3 minutes, elevating myself onto a stage. I think it's all very unequal to do that. I don't think it's radical. I think it was radical when I was in a band in the 70s. I'm not sure it's so radical now. You know, there are ways to do it that are radical, but I don't think standing on a stage, elevating yourself up above people, everyone looking up and clapping every 3 minutes at your songs, I don't think that's radical. But anyway, yeah, so I think it needs unpicking. And so I think that's what's at the back of her statement, that anger is old-fashioned. I mean, she was only about 15 when she said it, but I've waffled on a bit because it's this sort of delicate area without sounding too down on young people, but also I think there is a different path for privileged young people now, and hopefully, and I do think they can see that, a lot of them, you know. I don't know. I've got faith in young people, yeah.
Most of the questions have come from over here. Are there questions in this region?
My question is, what was it like for you as a young woman to travel with the Slits and play in the United States for the very first time? Was it culture shock for you?
It was culture excitement. It was unbelievable because in the 70s, I mean, we had a TV, and on the TV, I think there were two programs a week that any young person could look at. There was no youth culture. There was no courting of the youth, you know, sort of through consumerism or making programs for them. So I'd never heard an American accent in real life until I met Johnny Thunders in 77. So when I went to New York in 1978 or 79, whenever it was, I couldn't believe shops opened late. I mean, it's all normal to you, but like this 1940s Britain I was in, to suddenly stores that sold ice cream at midnight. You know, when you order a sandwich, you've got potato chips with it. I don't know. Everything was so exciting. Everything was unbelievable. The energy on the streets, street performers. It still holds a real magic to me, all of America, but New York and San Francisco and L.A. especially. And I don't know, I was saying to my daughter on the phone this morning, you know, it's so magical, you've got to come over here. I'd forgotten how much this country does excite me. And I was saying to her, I wonder if it's because we mostly know about America through films and TV. And so therefore it's always slightly removed, slightly mythological to us. But to me, I definitely find it terribly exciting. But I mean, I remember when we got off at JFK and we all piled into a yellow cab and we were absolutely blown away. And the yellow cab took off, went down the freeway, and then the hood popped up. He was blinded, the driver, you know. And then things like the music was blaring and he was blinded and he careered over to the side and we thought we were going to die. But it was just so terribly exciting. And I feel sorry for people who won't, you know, because now when British people come here, it's, you know, we know so much about the culture here and I watch so much American TV and everything. But it was like another world. And LA, when we went there and, you know, just the palm trees and the flat buildings, I thought I'd hate LA, but I thought that was another magical place as well. And yeah, I mean, I was absolutely knocked out by it. And it felt slightly like a playground. That there's this thing in America that we don't have in Britain where, you know, there's a sort of enjoyment of things like food there, and food in Britain, at that time, it was an absolute duty to eat, you know. If you didn't eat, you starved. But apart from that, there was no fun around anything. I mean, even when we rode, went horse riding, sort of American style, great big comfy saddle that you lean back in and you just flick the reins that way if you want it to go right. Whereas in England, you're perched up there, you could keep your knees in, you're right over. I mean, it's it's just the difference in all those cultures, but in a good way. I found it wonderful, yeah, and I'll never forget. And it's very hard to explain how different America was to us, how little we knew of it, and that how it made it so exciting, yeah.
We should never forget that there are many different kinds of freedom, and we so often take for granted the atmosphere of freedom that we live in and is so strange to people from around the world. We have time for maybe two more questions.
So I just have to speak because you were important to me when I was a teenager, and it was really exciting, and we kind of followed a bunch of your shows, and I want to ask something important, and nothing important is coming to me. And I just have to say two things. One is, I'll give you an example of how you're important. So we didn't have health insurance, and my friend fell, and she had a huge slit, ironically, in her leg, and we had to go to urgent care, and she had to fill out forms, but we didn't have insurance, so she had to put a fake name, and she wrote Viv Albertine.
In thanks. York, so I'm going to be Beach, done for that.
York Beach, Maine, in 1977 or whatever, yeah. 78 or something. And anyway, so the question that did come to my mind is, I remember in Boston you were running around in these outfits from the 1800s, these long dresses, all of you. Do you remember that and why? I just...
Oh. Are you sure?
Yes, absolutely. You played the Bradford Ballroom and yeah. It was crazy, but maybe you don't remember.
Yeah, where did we get them from? No, I don't know. We might have been wearing long things. We used to wear wraps or long ballet dresses and then dress them up with DMs and punk or S&M stuff. I mean, we used to try and sort of into mingle. Or we dressed in a way that how a girl was supposed to be. I don't know if you have brownies and guides here and that sort of thing, and go to ballet school. And we used to take all those sort of clothes, and they were all too small for us by then, and put them all together, so and try and sort of look like what a woman was supposed to be looked like, but all jumbled up at once. And it was quite horrific. So that might have been part of that. We might have had a long dress on and, old man's shoes, and then a bit of S&M gear and a brownie uniform on top, and that was part of what we were doing, sort of trying to sort of show visually how ridiculous the expectations of women were and girls. That might have been, that's all I can think of.
One more.
Yeah, I just had two quick questions. What is a box room? And the second is, I guess you're an intersection of punk and film. And I was wondering if there was a movie that came to mind that kind of captured the essence of it or that you found the most authentic.
Right, so Box Room is, and I watch HGTV nonstop when I'm over here. And I don't think you have such a thing as a box room, which is a room that's so tiny you can barely get a bed in it. And it's really the room you would put your boxes in. But in London or in Britain, where... The sort of rooms we live in are so small that often that room is, one of the children gets that room as a bedroom. So that's the room I end up in, the box room, whenever I ran back to mum because my life had fallen apart. But and a film that brings some of the punk spirit. But the thing is, most films are made by men, and therefore, it's quite hard for me to think of one, because I could definitely think of a few sort of wild, energetic films, but I don't really want to say them because guys thought them up and there's usually guys starring in them. And I'm sure there are others, but my mind's gone completely blank because I do think the film industry, with Ava DuVernay and is getting interesting at last. And, there are a few female cinematographers. But so there probably are. I would just say it's punk from my point of view, from the Slits point of view, just to have women cinematographers and directors. That's punk enough for me. I don't care what they make. that's, you know, that's just great that they're at last, you know, 40 years after I was interested in it, beginning to break through, which is slow, but it's better than nothing, I suppose. It's a very, very male industry, obviously.
There is a Slits movie playing in England now. Have you seen it?
I haven't. I've done one interview for it. I wasn't really involved in it. I've heard it's got lots of old footage in it, which I think is great for that to be sort of all collated together. But, you know, I'm not really into going over all that too much or being part of that or sort of, you know, nostalgia wasn't the ethos at the time. It was about leaving the past behind, moving forwards, not looking like people who dressed in a certain way 30 years ago or, you know, it was about moving forward, so I still keep that ethos, and I'm not really interested in rehashing it that much. I mean, I'm happy about talking about it here if, you know, it's interesting in this sort of intimate situation, but in terms of sort of making a film about it or whatever, I quite like that Joe Corry, who was the son of Malcolm McLaren, I know it's quite contentious, but he burnt all of a couple of million pounds worth of Malcolm McLaren's punk T-shirts and stuff from the 70s, which I totally understood because we at that time were all very much against deifying and worshipping people or clothes, and the clothes were all shoved together very quickly, turned inside out, you know, sleeves cut off, something strong written across the front, and for it to end up in museums and people's collections, which is what's happening to it, is utterly against what we were, you know, part of. It was not meant to be something that ended up in museums. I mean, we just had the Year of Punk last year. They wanted me to talk at the British Museum, the British Library, everywhere that would have nothing to do with us, obviously, at the time. You know, no one ever played the Slits on the radio. And it's too late. You know, you had the chance then to be part of it. The establishment weren't interested. Well, I'm not interested now. So that's slightly what I feel about, you know, films about it all and whatever, you know, things in museums and art galleries about it.
Well, we're out of time, but Viv will be signing books just out there. This book, which has a real cover, not doesn't look like this. Unfortunately, they don't have the Vermilion border, which is an album that you made in 2012.
Yeah,
2012. Yeah. It's a wonderful record. With an ending, the last cut. Still England.
Still England, yeah. The last word on the album starts with C and ends with T.
Still England, a wonderful track with dozens and dozens of names that you simply throw out there as part of your life and part of your atmosphere.
I mean, I left a load of people out just to say, because I had to stick to English people because of the song, but that's why it's
right.
That list.
So, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Viv, for being here.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.